Tonight on Arena, poet Paul Muldoon on a new book, Custom of the Coast, and Bad Monkey, Emily in Paris and Kidnapped are our TV shows for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. To say the least, Paul Muldoon has an extensive and varied CV. He is first and foremost a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. He is also a collaborator with Paul McCartney, frontman with his own band Rogue Oliphant, and ringmaster of Muldoon's Picnic, a touring show in which writers and musicians perform. We last spoke to him in April about his new poetry collection, Joy in Service, on Rue to Gore. Tomorrow evening, Paul marks the launch of his new libretto, Custom of the Coast, at Kilkenny Arts Festival. It tells the story of two women, Anne Bonny, the 18th century pirate born in Kinsale, and Savita Halappanavar, whose tragic death in 2012 in Galway caused a national protest that mobilised the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment of the Irish Constitution. The opera Custom of the Coast will be premiered in full next year at Kilkenny, directed by Alan Gilsonan. In the meantime, the libretto has been published by Gallery Press with illustrations by the artist Martin Gale, and I'm delighted that Paul Muldoon is with me in studio. So nice to have you here in person, Paul.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Now we're going to put you to work first. You're going to read a section. Does it need any introduction?
Well, as you mentioned, the two characters, there are really only two characters in this piece, though, of course, there's going to be a string quartet and an accordionist, So the music will also be a character. But the two main characters, as you say, are Savita Halappanavar and Anne Bonny. And Anne Bonny kicks off the proceedings. I'll read a little bit of her, how she begins. Might just set the scene, the deck of a sloop, a cross tree, a voluminous scrim. Anne Bonny is wearing a loose-fitting shirt and trousers. Roisin, I wish you'd dry your tears for all that fate's occasioned. The monks have taken to their three-mast ships. They've sailed across the ocean. Your pardon will come from the Pope, a stay of execution, and we won't stint on Spanish wine to toast my dark-haired Roisin. And we can see already that this is in conversation with Roisin Dhu. Some sing a snatch of a song, some sing a song of a snatch. In the town of Kinsale, where I was born, the pike lay under the thatch. The pike lay under the thatch, under the master, his servant girl. The deck would roll, the deck would pitch, the sea swell, the sea swirl. The sea swell, the sea swirl, my father left Ireland in disgrace. Not exactly the flight of the earls, a lawyer hoping to save face. And you can see that it's using a kind of balladic structure here. It's not the only structure it uses, but the ballad, perhaps even a sea shanty. A lawyer hoping to save face, stealing away with his bastard child. His wife's family might give chase. In Galway, we'd wait for the turning tide. In Galway, we'd wait for the turning tide, even as the crew was learning the ropes. My father looked back across the countryside. 1708, Ireland was stretched like a corpse. Ireland was stretched there like a corpse laid out by an open grave. On every side, men getting to grips, armed to the teeth with pitchforks and pike staves. And there's a slightly naughty, a mischievous little connection there with the arm to the teeth, because, of course, Savita Halappanavar was a dentist in Galway, a voluminous scrim, sari orange, a dentist's office, a reclining chair, a scintillation of steel implements, a white jacket. Savita sings, I was already armed with my diploma in dentistry, when I moved to Ireland in 2008. I'd come to join my husband, Praveen. We'd met on a matrimonial website. Some call that a blind date. He was already working in Galway for Boston Scientific. Defibrillators, drug-eluting stents. For the longest time, we kept in touch by Skype. That was the first test we underwent. So that's the introduction of the characters, and they continue in that vein, and they continue separately, as it were. But of course, what's happening in the piece is eventually their stories do, however unlikely it might seem, their stories do combine.
So unlikely it might seem, where did these two stories come and meld in your imagination?
You know, I can't remember exactly how it happened. Of course, the story of Savita Halappanavar was one that I think shocked, I think is the only word for it, shocked all of us, and that could happen in modern Ireland was just a deeply troubling moment for all of us. And of course, the outcome of it was a blessing in its way, but it's a dubious blessing, the fact that she had to die to help achieve that victory, as it were, is troubling, is the word I'm going to use again and again. So somehow the idea, of course, of her dying because she was with child, it's a rather, in many ways, simplistic connection between the two, because Anne Bonny lived because she was with child. When she was sentenced to death for her piratical activities, she pleaded the belly, as they say.
The belly.
Pleaded the belly. This was a technical term. Please forgive me if it's not. It's a bit early in the evening, perhaps, to be talking about that. But she pleaded the belly and said she was with child and should not be executed. So it's the paradoxical nature of these two stories that eventually come together around that idea that I'm interested in.
Yes, and there's also the idea that Savita was the immigrant in Ireland who comes with this rich culture of her own, and also that, as you talked about, Ireland being stretched out like a corpse, that the Bonnies, Anne Bonny and her father, had to leave Ireland to search. Well, she searched for adventure, but to search for a new life.
Well, that's right. And that again, paradox is at the heart of this. You know, the far-fetched coming together of these two stories is really something that we're engaged with again and again in all forms of art making. You know, the simile, the metaphor, to work must engage with two very far-flung, very distinct ideas. There's no point in saying, my love is like my love, or a red rose is like a red rose. But if you say my love is like a red, red rose, then you're in somewhat in business. So the far-fetched aspect of the story is one, I think, that's going to appeal to the composer, who's an Indian-American composer, Kamala Sankaram, who's done all kinds of astonishing work over the years. I came across her, as it happens, at Glimmerglass, which is an opera festival in New York, Upper New York State, where she had been involved in a youth opera about the Jungle Book. But she's no less interestingly, perhaps, has composed a piece called A Last Stand, which is created for the trees in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. So that's pretty out there.
So you don't think she's going to fall in a faint when she reads your libretto and say, what am I going to do with this to connect these two wonderful but very diverse stories?
No, I think she may have written a bit of the music, but we're really just starting on that aspect of it. She has a piece called Looking at You, which includes live data mining of the audience. I'm not quite sure if she's going to be doing that in Custom of the Coast. I don't think so. It's going to be somewhat more traditional, as I say, with a string quartet drawn, I think, from Crash Ensemble and the aforementioned accordionist. But I think it's going to, what I'm saying here, I suppose, is there is going to be it's a conventional enough piece, but I think there's going to be a slightly wacky component to it.
Now, modern opera, of course, explores serious issues. Did you have any hesitation about exploring Savita's story in an artistic way and putting it into the opera, given the tragedy it has caused to her family?
You know, I think when one is dealing with quote-unquote true stories, there's even an even greater sense of responsibility. It's a true story, but it's, for better or worse, it's a true story that is part of our collective imagination and experience now. So one wants to be truthful, and you know, my feelings for her are, you know, the deepest regard. And I was very taken early on by her parents thinking of her and her story as being an opportunity to actually do some good in the world. So that really was what prompted me partly to do it. But of course, as you're suggesting, I think the fact that it is somewhat a little bit of a biopic does raise difficulties for the writer, in the sense that you know, the life does not have the kind of arc necessarily that art generally adores, right? Things are not cut and dried. They're not neat. Narrative arcs in real life are not the same as they are in art. But alas, the tragedy in this case is sufficient to the making of what I hope will be a piece of art that will be a credit to her memory.
You talked there on the beginning, the Anne Bonny piece, about Roisin Dubh, and you said sea shanty, you said ballad. Are they art forms, or are they poetry forms? Not, the sea shanty is more a song, obviously, but the ballad, is that something you're interested in as a poet?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no accident that if one opens, say, the Norton Anthology of Poetry in English, one has to work one's way through acres of ballads before one gets to whatever, what would often be thought of as the main event. I don't think of the ballad as being anything less than the main event. It's such an extraordinarily robust form. One, I think that, like many of these inherited forms, the sonnet, say, still allows us plenty of room for manoeuvre. So it is certainly a component, that four-line stanza, usually rhyming on the second and fourth lines.
And when it comes to Savita's story then, how did you, as a poet, explore it? In poetic form.
Well, I mean, she you know, she also is speaking for the most part in these four line stanzas, though there are components of actually a Hindi stanza form, poetic form, called the ghazal, G-H-A-Z-A-L, Ghazal. It's pronounced in different ways. Ghazal, Ghazal. It's actually related to the word gazelle, apparently. Repetition, of course, is a feature of all these forms. And the Ghazal has a very particular use of a tag line, which is repeated right the way through. And repetition, of course, is one of the mainstays of music. And it's one of the reasons why I think the two are going to combine quite beautifully.
And it also gives you an opportunity, doesn't it, to explore Indian-Irish relations and the connection early on in the birth of both nations. Let's say Ireland, the 1916 rising would have inspired Nero, for example.
It did indeed. And that's something I think that actually I've talked to many Indian people about this, and I'm not sure if they're all as aware as they might be of the connection between, say, the Irish flag and the Indian flag, and the fact that the Indian Revolution took place on at Easter, which is hardly a religious calendar day in India, I think, for the most part, but they were inspired by the Irish experience. Certainly. So there something is made. I'm not going to say much is made, but something is made of the fact that there is a real connection between the two countries.
Now, you talked about what the family wanted. You wanted the family to feel, because they got involved in the campaign and they wanted to highlight what had happened to Savita, and their resolution, I suppose, in their own minds was that she had in some ways helped change the law or the constitution in Ireland. In terms of your work as a poet, and in this case a libretto, what would you be hoping to do in terms of Savita?
Well, one of one's responsibilities, I'm not sure if one has many responsibilities, but actually as a citizen, poets do have something along the lines of responsibilities. I think one wants to be responsible to one's moment and to the key events in the era in which one is living. And certainly for everyone in Ireland, the story of Savita Halappanavar is one that is deeply significant to who we are and where we are. And I think actually it was a moment that defined who we are as a culture. So in a modest way, one might like, I would hope that this will be a little notation, acknowledgement, and in fact celebration of that.
When we go to the Anne Bonny character then, looking at Martin Gale's illustrations and your own, I mean the derring do of the seafarer, of the pirate, you have great fun with that, as does he.
Well, I do, and of course, our notion of the pirate was based for the most part by a book called A History of the Pirates by Charles Johnson. There's some question as to whether or not that was a pseudonym for, well, actually, among others, Daniel Defoe, though it's generally now felt that Defoe was not the author of it. But our sense of how pirates behave in the world, that was deeply influenced by that book by Charles Johnson, a big influence on, of course, one of the greatest presenters of the pirate world, Robert Louis Stevenson, in Treasure Island, but also Peter Pan, the Barry. Barry's characters are somewhat based on what he learned from Charles Johnson. And so our sense of what pirate life might have been like is deeply influenced by that. But The thing that most interested me about pirate life, and which gives the piece its title, Custom of the Coast, is the fact that there was a very, very deeply ingrained and codified code of behaviour and a code of honour among those thieves. And of course, that's one of the reasons why I use it as a title for the piece, in that it refers, ironically, I suppose, to the legal and ethical issues raised by abortion, in this case, in 21st century Ireland. So they had their own perverse, perhaps in some ways, system of honour and ethics.
Well, we're looking forward to the opera, which will be next year, Paul.
Absolutely. We're thrilled to think that it's going to be in Kilkenny next summer. So I hope we'll all get a chance to see it.
Well, Customs of the Coast is published by Gallery Press. Paul Muldoon reads from Customs of the Coast tomorrow at 6 p.m. at Kilkenny Arts Festival. And from his latest poetry collection, Joy in Service, Route to Gore, that you spoke to us about earlier in the year. And that's all happening on Friday. Further details from kilkennyarts.ie. Paul Muldoon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Now it's time for our Arena TV reviews. First up, we have the latest offering from Apple TV Plus, Bad Monkey, starring Vince Vaughn as the boozy, easygoing ex-detective Andrew Yancey, who was fired from the Miami Police Department and is now a health inspector. No sooner have we said goodbye to the Paris Olympics than Netflix brings us back with the fourth season of Emily in Paris. Lily Collins is back as the titular American in Paris, dealing with life, love and Parisian drama, Queens Aplenty. Lastly, the BBC bring us Kidnapped, a drama based on the true story of the disappearance of the British glamour model Chloe Ayling, who was abducted when she turned up for a modelling assignment in Milan. I'm joined in studio by Alan Carr and Jen Gannon, who have watched all the series for us. Let's start with Bad Monkey. It's based on the 2013 novel of the same name by Carl Hyson, and in it Vince Vaughn plays the disgraced detective Andrew Yancey, and it streams on Apple TV today. So Jen, this is clearly a vehicle for Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, and that, you know, doesn't really, it's not something that would fill me with joy usually.
If you are not a fan.
This is a new Vince Vaughn vehicle. I mean, he started out, he had this really promising career back in like the early 90s, and he was kind of playing this slick smoothie in Jon Favreau's Swingers, and that brought him the attention to Hollywood. But then over the years, it's kind of curdled into, he's playing these roles where he's like this beef-headed slacker every man, and he's always popping up with these very forgettable rom-coms throughout the 2000s. But then when he tries his hand at something serious like the second season of True Detective, which was a complete mess, it makes it difficult for you to take him seriously too. So the thing is, I was thinking, Bad Monkey, is this going to be something I'll enjoy? And do you know what? Funnily enough, it actually fits him so well, like a badly made suit in a way. And he plays, as he said, this very easygoing, boozy disgraced detective, Andrew Yancey. And it's a bit Big Lebowski-esque in the way that he is this almost bumbling through life, and he just wants an easy life, and he just wants to stay out of the drama, but the drama, he keeps on attracting it. And as he said, he was thrown out of the Miami Police Department because there was a fracas with him and his would-be lover, Bonnie, who's played by the first season of True Detectives, Michelle Monaghan, her awful husband, and it saw him, you know, escape into the Florida Keys, and now he's kind of just lounging around. And then his ex-partner Rogelio, played by John Uritz, he arrives at his door and says, look, I have something for you, you might be interested in.
Okay, we have a clip here. This is the Vince Vaughn character, Andrew Yancey, who is on suspension from his job as a detective and is being asked to help out in the case by his former partner Rogelio, and that's played by John Uritz.
Sonny wants you to take a quick road trip to Miami. Okay, you, Miami, little police business, pop, 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 in and out.
I can't do it, Ro. I'm technically not even a detective anymore.
We really have to do this dance?
Who's dancing? There's no dance. I'm suspended. What? How am I dancing?
No, it's the back and forth.
There's no back and forth.
My brother, you want your job back very badly, right?
Yes.
Well, I've got something in my car that the sheriff wants you to drive to Miami.
Oh, look at me. I'm falling asleep. I'm so tired.
I know. You have your pride. So if you want to pretend for a minute that you don't want to do this errand, that's fine. But don't make me stand around here for fucking ever.
People can't suspend me and then expect things from me. It's not how it works.
Whatever. That's Barbin Court, right?
Thankfully, yes. But I unfortunately don't have a glass for you.
I'll take yours.
Before he got suspended, Yancey and Roe were partners. Hell, sometimes that's even worse than being married. Over the years, Roe had learned how to get exactly what he wanted from his friend. All it took was a little patience.
So what's in the car?
Okay, so he's excited. He's interest. But who is that third voice that comes in there, Alan? There's a narrator voice.
There is a narrator. The actor, I don't know him actually, but he's this gravelly voice dude, which lends it that big Lebowski quality that Jen was talking about. And this narrator takes a rather meta approach to telling the story. Like, he talks about the conceits and the nature of storytelling itself. He even at one point apologizes to the viewer about the kind of detours and the twists the plot is taking. The plot revolves around this.
You can hold your idea about the plot. I just wanted to know about the narration for now.
Okay.
Because with our new time slot, it's now coming up to the Newark at 7. So stay with us, and Jan and Alan will be previewing the rest of the TV shows. Welcome back to Wednesday Night's Arena at our new time slot, which goes from 6:30 to 7:30. In studio with me are Alan Carr and Jen Gannon, who've been looking at the new TV shows on offer. Alan, you were just about to tell me the plot lines in Vince Vaughn's new Apple TV show, Bad Monkey.
Yeah, so Vince Vaughn as the disgraced or suspended at least Miami police detective is kicking back at home, enjoying watching the world go by until his former partner drops by with a very grisly surprise. It is a severed arm, which has been fished out of the sea by a honeymooner on a chartered fishing trip. Now, interestingly, this arm, Kay, is giving the middle finger. Rigor mortis, we're told, and there's a watch missing from the arm's wrist. However, a very expensive wedding ring is still intact. Now, the local sheriff is very unhappy about this discovery because he thinks it might spook the tourists. So he basically asks Yancey to dispose of this offending limb, the severed arm of the law, as opposed to the long arm of the law. But Yancey, being the kind of person he is, he's very curious, and his kind of interest is piqued. So he decides to pursue the mystery of the severed arm. And this kind of leads him into a very murky world of greed and crime and all kinds of strange, murky shenanigans going on down in the Florida Keys, which is very kind of Carl Hiaasen, the author of the
Jen,
piece.
Jen, Florida Keys and beyond. Then there's another subplot, side
there
plot.
Is. There's a lot of plot in this series, and it's 10 episodes. So, I mean, it wants to draw you in and pull the story out. So it kind of has this kind of Elmore Leonard light plotting, where you have this cast of very colourful characters. So you have Florida going on at one point. Meanwhile, over in the Bahamas, you have Neville, who's played by Ronald Peete, and his pet monkey Diggs. And everybody knows who Diggs is. It's Crystal the monkey, which you've seen in the Hangover, all the Hangover films. There's been Crystal the monkey shimmying around on the red carpet in her gorgeous designer dresses. So she's back, which she is the titular bad monkey. And
it is that actual monkey.
It is the monkey from the
same monkey goes in all these
exactly,
movies.
Well spotted.
So anyway, Neville is a similarly laid back type as well. And he wants the easy life too, and his own patch of the world, which is in the Bahamas. But then, you know, his life is going to get hard because these property developers from the US are coming in and they want to raise his place to the ground and put a 5-star resort there. So then, as Alan said, the narrator kind of apologizes for switching back and forth between these two stories. But, you know, there is a big twist which pulls these two stories together that I'm not going to give away. But I will say it involves Rob Delaney with a lovely buoyant moustache. So that's one to look out
Very
for.
Very luxurious moustache.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking you're liking it.
Weirdly.
In spite of your reservations about Fence Fawn.
Created by the Scrubs and Ted Lasso showrunner Bill Lawrence, and he has this great, him and Vince Vaughn are mates outside of it, and I think that's what works well. He can capture the dialogue, the kind of back and forth, that kind of sardonic nature of Vince Vaughn, and the dialogue does crackle, and there's a lot of really good witty zippy jokes in it, and I think it's a Shaggy Dog story, and he embodies that character, that kind of world weary character, well. And you know, I found myself being, even though it is heavily indebted to the Coen brothers, it is this unexpectedly engaging trip, and I think people will go with it. They'll go with it over the 10
episodes. Stars out of 5 from you.
I'll give it a solid 3.
And from you, Alan, what did you think?
I enjoyed it for the episodes I saw. There's 2 available at the moment. It's 10 episodes long, 10 hours long in total. I liked it. 3 out of 5 as well.
3 out of 5, both for Bad Monkey, and that's on Apple TV Plus. Netflix brings us back to Paris with the 4th season of Emily in Paris. Were you a fan of season 1, 2 and 3, Alan?
I don't know. I didn't watch them.
Have you a clue what's happening?
Well, I do now. This is the first time I've kind of had a look at Emily for Paris. I have resisted it. I mean, this show is not made for the likes of me. I understand the phenomena surrounding it, etc., etc., and it has quite a cult following. But quite apart from the fact that it's not designed for a middle-aged man like me, it is badly written, it's badly acted, and it looks so gauche and gaudy and terribly kind of icky. I think the acting is very poor. The only person to me who made an impression as an actor was Lily, daughter of Phil Collins, who plays the titular Emily. The rest are particularly wooden. I thought the male cast in particular, the lead male cast, were particularly awful. But the show is not made for me. It's about Emily, Emily Cooper, this American girl in Paris who ends up working in a marketing company to introduce the French market to American tastes. And it's all about her kind of run-ins with in work, her love life, and dealing with the legendary Parisian temperament. I think it's worth bearing in mind that the French audience are not fans of this. I think it's the equivalent of the time EastEnders came to Ireland and we all had goats in the parlour. So it's seen as very stereotypical
and cliched. Yeah, but I can imagine an awful lot of young girls listening to your review going, oh my God, he's missing the point completely.
Well, it's not for me.
Yes. How are you a fan, Jen?
I love, like, compulsive TV, and I think Darren Starr, who is the creator of Emily in Paris, he knows what compulsive TV is. He's, you know, creator of Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place. You know, he had a hand in Sex and the City. Also, he's responsible for What Is and Just Like That, which we're all very confused over. So Emily in Paris kind of takes that mantle over, where it is this television that you can't stop watching it. It's like The Simpsons Tomaco, where it's like, you know, a mixture of tomatoes and tobacco, where you're like, you know, it's disgusting, but it's still ongoing. Your eyeballs are still, it's still a feast for your eyes in a way.
And beautiful setting of Paris that we all fell in love with again within the Olympics. And here you've got fashion shows, you've got beautiful cafes.
And low stakes. This is the point of this. This is TV you watch where you have one eye on your phone, and because nothing ever changes. We're in it. This is 4 years since, like, we started on this journey with Emily, and she is still doing these whoopsie mishaps about, you know, the French temperament. I don't know what you're saying still after 4 years, or I don't know why my boss hates me because you're never in work, Emily. But, you know, we're still at those same rudimentary problems, and it feels like a show that could just slip by on a Sunday afternoon, and it is completely critic proof. There is nothing I could say that would make fans want to not engage with it, and that's fine. And I think it's fine to have Emily twirling around in her gorgeous selection of Valentino dresses on, you know, various Parisian bridges and fight over very bland men, two very bland men. But at the same time, I understand that it's the ultimate kind of switch off escapist TV.
Okay, well, I have a clip of one of the bland men, or about one of the bland men. In this clip, Julianne, who is played by Samuel Arnold, he works in the agency that Emily works in. He's giving a presentation on the new scent Ami, where Emily, played by Lily Collins, and her boyfriend Alfie have been chosen as the pivotal couple in the campaign. They are the couple who are so much in love. To Emily's discomfort, however, because she has broken up with Alfie.
Love is in the air. We are thrilled for the launch of our Love It In The Air campaign starring our very own Emily Cooper.
We tested all of the couples in the balloons and you two scored the highest by far. You can't fake the look of love in the air.
Our outdoor campaign launched today in Paris, New York, and Seoul, and we're premiering the ad on the big screen at Roland Garros tomorrow, where we plan to host our happy couple in the Ami Courtside box.
You both must be there. We want it to be interactive, the Ami couple in the flesh and in love and on the big screen.
There is something you should say.
Stop whispering. Everyone can hear you.
I have an idea. If you really want it to be interactive, then why not get the whole stadium involved? Mm-hmm. Let the camera roam and find other couples in love, like a kiss cam.
Qu'est-ce que c'est une kiss cam?
Oui, Emily, qu'est-ce que c'est une kiss cam?
You find couples in love in the audience, and when they're on the Jumbotron, they kiss. They do it at the Cubs games.
Right, like a camera bisou.
Oui, oui, bisou, bisou for everyone. Right. It's way better than me and Alfie, you know. Yeah, you don't even need us.
No. Bisou for you too, for the entire world.
Oui, oui, oui. Oui, Emily. The Yami campaign is about the love story between you and Alfie.
Exactement.
Now, Alan, the exciting thing about season four is that the Eurovision Song Contest plays a central role. We're hoping. Are we?
Yes, apparently so. As a neophyte, a newcomer to the show, Emily's bestest, Emmy, who is Mindy, I think, her kooky pop trio are trying out to represent France in the upcoming Eurovision Song Contest. Now, whether you find this an endearing and fascinating thing or not is down to
your... Oh, I thought you did. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
no, yeah. That's down to whether one likes the Eurovision Song Contest or not. I mean, as you can tell from that clip you played there, I mean, there's no surprise in the show, Kay, that the dialogue is like one long string of emojis and memes. Which is just as well, because it's a huge hit with influencers. They seem to like the fashion, as you can tell by looking at me. I'm not a fashionista, but I found the clothes absolutely extraordinarily awful. And I think Lily Collins... I'm really not going for this, I'm afraid. Look, it's perky and it's quirky, but I'd have to say that, you know, I really think that the only time the Americans were really welcome in Paris was in 1944. And this is why, you know, Parisians and French people do not like this show. And I would have to agree with them.
I thought it at the beginning of Emily in Paris, it was more interesting when everybody didn't have so much money. Yeah. Whereas it has become now, again, haute couture rather than street fashion. It's become, you know, chateaus rather than side street cafes.
This
I think that's
always
a real disappointment.
Darren Star's problem. This is always Darren Star's problem. If you look at something like Sex and the City, or you look at something like even Melrose Place or his other newer dramas like Younger, he puts a lot of countenance into having money because it's easier to film where you are in these fabulous locations and it looks so glamorous. But because of that, the storylines kind of almost suffer because nobody is struggling, nobody is having a hard time. And that is kind of where this goes. It's engaging with people on a fairy tale level of... It's an easy watch because we always know that nothing is going to go wrong, really, for Emily. Everything's going to work out okay in the end. And I know a lot of young people want to engage with that because the world is a very fraught place and it is great escapism in that way. But I do think it deserves better writing. At this stage, we're at season four. And as I said, everything's the same. Nothing
Presumably
has
it's the
on.
Last season, is it?
I do not know. I mean, she's had a fringe. She's gotten a fringe. That's her. She's moving into fringes. That's
the bangs
the
are
only
down,
thing
yeah.
that's changed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what it is, when it started, it was like this very Americanized version of what Americans think Paris is like or what they think is romantic, like in Parisian, the way that, like... Americans perceive
yes,
Paris
like funny
in culture,
or like that. Yeah.
Ratatouille. Even you have the little chef,
American
the little chef
Paris.
Man, and like it's kind of like The Devil Wears Prada, but without that sharpness to it. There's no bite to it. You have Sylvie as her despairing boss, who was absolutely brilliant. You know, Philippine Loa Bolu, who we know from Call Me Agent, she's still amazing, and she has this great subplot, which is like a Me Too kind of subplot. And I wish. That's like a separate show. It's almost like a different show. And I wish the focus was on her.
We've one more show. So stars out of five, I don't think there'll be many.
Well, I thought this was kind of like as insubstantial as a bowl of onion soup. It's like a hot dog shoved into a creme brulee. I would give it a half star out of five if I could.
Thank you for working so hard on the similes.
And I can't wait to watch the rest of it.
I'll give it a 2.5. I think it's there for really, I don't know. I just think people are persevering because they just find it glamorously escapist, and that's about the only really good thing you can say about it. It's not really about the writing anymore, if it ever was.
Okay, so we move on to the final series, and that's from the BBC. It's Kidnap, the Chloe Ayling story. Alan, what can you tell us about Chloe Ayling and what befell her?
Well, Chloe Ayling was a 30-year-old British glamour model who was abducted in Milan in 2017 when she was on a modelling job which was booked under false pretences. And this is a dramatisation of the ordeal she went through for 5 days. When she turned up at the apartment where she was meant to meet the booker in Milan, she was handcuffed, injected with ketamine, and driven out to an isolated farmhouse outside of Turin, where she was kept prisoner for 5 days by a gang purporting to be a Euro-wide criminal group called the Black Death, who were going to auction her off as a sex slave. And this series, this six-part series on BBC Three, tells the story of that ordeal and what she went through. And it's very much editorialised by Chloe Ayling herself, because on her return to Blighty, nobody or a lot of people didn't believe her story. And it became to me this kind of perfect intersection between social media, the online, you know, detectives, the true crime drama, also tabloid prurient. So a perfect confluence of our post-truth virtual age. So I think she's claiming back some of her own life with this dramatisation.
Yes, and she was never against, you know, going on the media, defending herself, even though many people ridiculed her whole story.
Yeah, I mean, she did appear on with Eamon Holmes on This Morning and then with Piers Morgan as well. And, you know, she was treated really badly by both men, I would say, because there is, you know, there's a lot of interest in subjects that are brought up through her story and the themes that are drawn out, that, you know, they're how we see survivors. If someone doesn't appear as a good, quote unquote, victim, and Chloe, she seems quite a blank person, a bit of a blank slate. They were complaining that of the clothes that she wore when she did a press conference when she came back. They also said they had photos of her and one of her kidnappers holding hands. And they really went heavy on victim blaming and victim shaming.
So, Jen, this production, in a word, if you could give it to me in stars, please.
I found it to be very effective. And I think if you have young women in your life, young teenage girls or girls in their early 20s, and they're interested in Instagram and Instagram modelling and etc., and how people perceive young people, I think is very interesting. So I'd give it a 3.
And you, Alan?
Well, I think this is a complicated story, controversial story. It's handled very well and it does keep you guessing. I'd give it 3 out of 5 as well.
3 out of 5. So that's Kidnap, the Chloe Ayling story on BBC, Emily in Paris on Netflix, and Bad Monkey on Apple TV. Alan Corr and Jen Gannon, thank you so much. More Kilkenny Arts Festival now. From this week till the 20th of September, the Butler Gallery, in association with the Kilkenny Arts Festival, is presenting Deep Time Dip by Liana Lang, a German-born London-based visual artist who explores time and memory through monuments and historical landscape in her mixed-media work. While Liana has exhibited widely both in Britain and internationally, this will be her first international solo show and her first exhibition in Ireland since she studied here in Dublin in the NCAD. Liana, you're very welcome.
Hello.
What can you recall of your time in Dublin and NCAD?
Oh, well, I had a wonderful time at NCAD, actually. It was very, very different to the sort of art academies I would have been offered in Germany. And so I started all my course there. So my very first year at university was there. Lovely community, great young lecturers. And also I pretty much got to dip into every technique that I later used. So they taught me photography, printmaking, mold making, sculpture, and even a very early Photoshop. was brilliant.
Oh, right. And indeed, you use so many techniques in your own work. Deep Time Dip, then. Tell us about the exhibition and the materials and the different techniques you use.
Okay, so the exhibition is on at the Butler Gallery and it's curated by Anna O'Sullivan. It was her idea really to bring together a few different bodies of work. So the majority of the exhibition is a series called Touchstone, which is the most recent work and the work I'm still working on now. But we also brought in two previous series, one called Monumental Misconceptions, which are statues of the Soviet era in Hungary that were, you know, that were taken down and put into a park. And the other series is called Glorious Oblivion, which is where I spent 3 years looking for statues of women across various cities in Europe. And so it all comes together as a kind of a story that does talk a lot about sculpture. My work always moves between sculpture and photography. There is a kind of conversation. It starts out in the exhibition, the earliest work is about 15 years old, and the work is very photographic, properly prints, framed, etc. And then it gets gradually more sculptural as we get to the more recent work.
So monuments are such a contested thing at the moment, you know, with people querying statues that may reference old slavers or and I guess the people in Eastern Europe were the first people to take a hand to the old regimes and tear down the monuments of the Soviet era. You visited some of those graveyards.
I did. Monumental Misconceptions is actually entirely photographed at the Memento Sculpture Park in Budapest, which has only Hungarian monuments. But I have been to several others. There's a few socialist statues left in Berlin. I'd say that taking down statues is as old as making statues. People have been sort of smashing statues for a very long time because we have a very symbolic relationship to statues. They're kind of proxy for the body. They're a proxy for a person or a political movement. And so they do suffer a lot of punishment. And, you know, if you want to set yourself a monument that'll last, I would suggest you do it in stone because bronze does tend to get melted down quite a lot.
So I'm looking at two pieces here now that we are tweeting as we go along. So the first is called Poster Boy and then the second is called Fellow Traveller. So these are monuments, but you have made your own insertion into them.
That's right. So all the figures in those images are actually sculptures that I've made in the studio. So they're body casts, absolutely life size from real people. So you can see the scale of the statue through that. They're also women. There are no women at all in the park. The statues are all of men. Poster Boy is the Republic of Councils monument, which is supposed to, of course, show the kind of power of the working man, but really, you know, dwarfs the real person that's standing below it. And that is how they were intended. So, you know, these statues would just suddenly appear in a park with no consultation at all. And we're kind of a demonstration of power and oppression to a certain extent. Yeah. And Poster Boy is the biggest statue in the park there. It's a really incredible.
And Fellow Traveller then?
Fellow Travellers is only a section of a larger monument to a socialist politician called Bela Kun, who actually didn't do anything much wrong. But his statue is very interesting from the materials, and I focused in on beaten steel and bronze sheeting. So I'm very interested in the materiality of sculpture, and I've inserted these very lifelike, you know, soft, delicate-looking legs in there. The term fellow travelers is something that that I've translated from the German word Mitläufer, which was used for people who were part of the Nazi regime, did various jobs, but later said that they were just fellow travelers, that they weren't really convinced by the ideology. So it's a slightly, contentious term.
Now, you said that you were interested in statuary regarding women, and this is the section Glorious Oblivion. So you went around the world, really, looking for statues done in honour of women, and then again did some of your own insertions or manipulations of.
That's right. I actually thought, because there were very, very few statues of women, or I knew of very few, that it would be an interesting thing to discover who had been depicted, you know, who had been given that honor of having a statue. And I did obviously, as you'd expect, find loads and loads of queens and quite a lot of saints. Often the queens are also saints. But I did also find lots of other women, and it was a fascinating way actually to immerse myself into a culture, because through the character of the, I'd try to read the book of the novelist or look at the work of the artist and kind of understand who they were. And it was a really fascinating, at times frustrating project. They were very hard to find. Often people very rarely knew who they were. They're not often the very best sculptures. And also, it does turn out that having a statue in your honour does not guarantee that you will be remembered.
And now we're looking at a picture featuring Joan and Maria. And the Joan is Joan of Arc, and the Maria is the character, or the robot from Metropolis, the Fritz Lang film.
That's right. And it seems a very strange pairing. It's because I photographed this at the Louvre plaster cast workshop. So this is a storage room, and they actually just sit there next to each other. The only addition I made is that little hand that Joan of Arc is resting on the robot Maria. It's a particularly close to me, that work, because I love Fritz Lang, and he was a very early influence on me, along with expressionist film in that kind of early period. I was always very interested in animation, and I also feel that his work now, you know, talking about technology, robotics, AI, it's become so incredibly prescient again.
Well,
and,
Well, there's lots more interesting interjections by you in this exhibition. Liana Lang, thank you so much. Her exhibition is running as part of Kilkenny Arts Festival in the Butler Gallery until the 20th of September. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwu and Paula Shields. Gar Duffy was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. And John Creedon is next.